Before we start this episode, I'd like to tell you a couple of things. You'll find the show notes and links to some of the topics covered in the episode at cherryleaf.podbean.com, and that's P-O-D-B-E-A-N. In the show notes, you'll also find information on how to subscribe to our free monthly newsletter, and also a link to information on our new Advanced Technical Writing e-learning course. Do give us a rating on iTunes or YouTube, and if you have any comments or other types of feedback, you can contact us via info@cherryleaf.com. This is the Cherryleaf podcast, and I'm Ellis Pratt from Cherryleaf, and I should do a drum roll. You are?
And I'm Anne Gentle. I currently work as a product manager at Cisco, but I've got a cool side project called Docs Like Code.
And you have a book, which is Docs as Code, which is out on lulu.com, which has been out for a few months now, hasn't it?
Right. And I registered both Docs as Code and Docs Like Code. And the book title is Docs Like Code, if you search for it. I don't know which is the actual grammatically preferred.
Docs as Code has really taken off as a trend and as a theme. And I guess you're the cheerleader or poster boy or whatever the right phrase is for this, the, one of the original proponents of it.
Number one fan. you know what? And I think that there were people that I follow, of course, Tom Johnson and others who are dabbling in this as well. And the more I looked at what was being written, and especially the Write the Docs community has embraced this wholeheartedly, I wanted not to be, oh, I'm first, or oh, I beat everybody, or, you know, not in a competitive manner, but more in like a, I have observed a lot of things in the last 7 years working on OpenStack and then moving to Cisco. And boy, I really want to find other practitioners, figure out where I'm doing it wrong, figure out what additional things we could be gaining, and just kind of write down what I was seeing, even, you know, as a practitioner. And in pivoting to being a product manager, I wanted to make a product. So guess what? I made a product.
Like all of these things, it often ends up with two or three people independently coming up with roughly the same idea, recognizing that they're all doing something pretty much the same, and then it becomes a meme, I suppose, or gets given a name and goes on
Definitely.
From there.
If I may, the introduction to the book, I kind of talked about the trends, especially in software. We're working more closely with developers and quality assurance and all of that. Mm. And so my other book is Conversation and Community, which is very much about collaborative writing and collaborative authoring. But to me, this is the next phase, is collaborating inside of these development systems, pulling the best possible practices to make our docs more efficient, to release with the software itself or the services that are built. You know, another trend is the explosion of REST APIs. If you follow that online programmable web research, has this exponential chart where from 2005 to 2013, 10,000 REST APIs showed up that were public, that had to be documented, right? So I think that's another theme that we're seeing, you know, the workplace changes and remote collaboration, the technology changes and the business forces that cause that, the rise of the REST API, the rise of REST web services where it's delivered, not as a CD or DVD that shows up at your door in a box, right? And then all the automation, it's an exciting world.
We've sort of dived into why do docs as code, but I think it might be useful to start by me asking the question, what is docs as code, or what you've written your book as, when you treat docs as code, what you mean by that? That's probably a good starting point.
And I actually have one in front of me. This gentleman, Matt Fleming, reached out to me through Write the Docs, had been asking about the book and asking questions about open source documentation. We started this email dialogue, and he actually came up with a wonderful 30-second pitch. So I'm going to use his, Matt Fleming, shout out, because I really like it. Docs Like Code is a method of writing documentation that reuses the best processes and tools for writing software. So using the same workflows for docs and code makes it easy for non-writers to contribute, to validate expert information, and use existing automation or create your own to produce docs quickly and reliably. And I really like how succinctly he put that, because I had to take 100 pages in a book to say all that.
Well, you also, you've got 5 bullet points in the book, which were store the doc, which is the same as what you've just read out, really. Store the doc source files in a version control system. Build the doc artifacts automatically, and we can come back to what that means. Ensure a trusted set of reviewers meticulously reviews the docs. Publish the artifacts without much human intervention. And these techniques constitute a docs-like code framework.
Well, I think in exploring this, I was also trying to figure out, when do you not want to do this? So we can get into that a little bit later. I think there are great reasons to do it, and the places where I've seen great success, are open source, highly collaborative environments, places where you can track defects, just like software. And I think especially when you're in an agile environment, the tighter you integrate with development practices, and especially in a continuous integration environment, the more tightly you can couple the documentation processes with the code delivery processes, the better. So we're not, like I said, we're not writing software that's delivered in a box. It's being delivered over the web. All the documentation is online for the most part. And if you are updating things, as quickly as Facebook rolls out updates or Amazon rolls out updates, then the documentation should be able to roll that quickly as well. And Waterfall isn't going to help you in an environment where everything else is not delivered Waterfall. So I have a lot of experience with agile documentation, and it's one of the most read posts on my Just Right Click blog from 2007. No kidding. These are, for whatever reason, I've been on the sort of leading edge, but I still get emails from people who are like, oh, I stumbled across this. It's been super helpful as we make a transition. And I think I feel a lot of empathy for that situation, right? Change is the constant. And so, how do you adapt, and how do you know which practices fit in well with what you're delivering today?
So one of the challenges with Agile, one of the underlying principles of Agile, is that it surfaces problems. And then when there is a problem, everybody in the team swarms around that problem and fixes it. Without docs-like code, you have a black box, which is an authoring system, and only the technical writer, the technical author, understands it. One of the promises I see with the docs as code approach, because it's in the same systems and can well use the same tools that developers use elsewhere, is that opportunity to swarm around a problem can also be extended to the documentation as well as the code. Now, I wonder in practice whether
trap. I have fallen into this trap myself, where I actually set up a docs code repository, but completely used a Jekyll Ruby system when the developers were using Python RST. And guess what? I didn't get any support from the development team. So I have fallen into this trap and had to solve things on my own. And I think that's another reason why I want to kind of set this up from use these tools and everything will be great, but more from like an integration and really pay attention to what is going to get you collaboration and sharing of tools quicker. There are mismatches that you can easily fall into. I've done it, did it myself. That's why I had to figure out how to do versions on Jekyll when I knew how to do it in Sphinx and RST and Python. But I mean, I think that's also part of, the ways that we can challenge and stretch ourselves is dabble a little more in web dev, but make sure you can get help when you need it. And honestly, I have to say, I think there are valuable reasons to have agile sprints, but set up for documentation independently from the possibly like services delivery teams. I'm a huge advocate for documentation as product. So go ahead and run your own sprints and set your priorities that match, that definitely march step with the other teams, but also have your own autonomy and opinions and beliefs and what's top priority for docs and users, right?
Okay, so let me ask a question which again relates to this, and that is when and where this approach might be applicable.
Yeah, so what I want to do next, I'm working on second edition of Docs Like Code and hope to have that out next month. where I've added information about the versioning of docs separate from product or in line with product, right? So I'm adding as I go, but here's the thing. No one actually has done the data-driven analysis of what does work best for docs like code. So, and the great thing is Troy Howard and I are conspiring to solve this, right? As well as, you know, other people in the community who are very interested in data and using web analytics to test how efficient and effective your docs are. But we all know web analytics isn't the whole story. And not every goal for a piece of documentation is the same. For some people, it's to buy. For some people, it's to grow the service. For some people, it's to make sure they don't make a support call, right? So I could list many different outcomes that would mean your docs are a success. How can we march backwards from that with data to say that these inputs on the contributor side affected an outcome? And so, you know, I feel like Troy's been working on, you know, dev.twitter for a while. He and I both have data on both sides that could be analyzed to say, okay, and his project is CodeWords, WERDD, to try to figure out, like, is a small team better because they move more quickly? Is moving quickly better? Is patching as quickly as possible, or is patching as accurately as possible better? Do you make small core review teams, but then set up huge commit teams that can make the commits and then have a small team that just does the reviews? There are so many levers we could pull here. And here's the trick. We need to correlate it to what is actually happening on the consumption side. So all of that is only collaboration side.
Yes.
That's the kicker, right? Anyway, go ahead. Yeah, now, ask me more because it's super interesting.
Well, you've got the issue of the quality. You've got the quality of what the end user gets, and then you've got, I suppose, the efficiency of how well the documentation is produced. Is it accurate? How many mistakes are there in it? How quickly does it get to market? And those things. Leading on from this is often, I guess, a criticism issue, I suppose, and you mentioned this with versioning, is often people build simple solutions for simple problems, and then over time, and APIs and REST APIs at the moment have been essentially simple. It's been in one language, English, there's been one version, it's been for web output only. And the tools like Flare and RoboHelp and FrameMaker are complex tools for complex problems. And so if and when these systems get more complex, where you mentioned versioning, you have version 1 and you have version 2, you have version 1.1, you have the main version, then you have a customized version for a specific customer, or a pro version and a light version. You have the English language version and you have the Chinese version. Has anyone tested the scalability and resilience of this approach? Has anyone tested this and pushed it to deal with those versioning and more complex things?
Right. And I think, again, that's where I want to share my stories on a couple things. So one is the contribution simplicity lever. A lot of writers are using what I've heard called white coat tools. I'm the doctor here. I will pay thousands of dollars per seat to solve your illness, right? But in my world, which was OpenStack in this super growth period, I had developers who were like, Anne, I am never going to leave my terminal window to work on docs. You need to make it easier. You need to make it parallel with what I'm doing already. And so we had a bit of a seesaw going on. And so early days, when I was looking for contributors, I felt it was best to find writers who were already in the docbook ecosystem. And of course, I had an IBM person come ask, why didn't you choose Ditta, knowing OpenStack would be internationalized, right? And so at the time, Red Hat was going to be one of the big distros. They knew they had docbook already in their toolkit. So there was a distinct analysis I had to make ahead of time. I still feel like I made the right choice for that moment in time, in that context. So that was 2010. Fast forward to 2014. We forklifted every single bit of XML in our documentation repo, which was being treated like code, but was not quite like the code everyone else was in, and forklifted it all to Python RST with Sphinx build automation as opposed to an XML Maven build automation. Now, all that to say, in 6 months' time, I had XML experts at IBM who are also translation experts step up and build me a tool chain that would do translations with docs coming out of the repo that were XML. She built the slicer tool. She had a way to automate all of the output to the translation tool they were using at the time and bring it back in and build automatically still. So I'm not one to say that they're in any given moment of time, in any given analysis, you will find the right thing. And what was amazing about what I experienced was I had people stepping up and making things because we were an open source community and we made open source things who solved the problem. It was amazing. So, yeah, I mean, I don't want to say that'll only happen in open source because, of course, that's too reaching. But I guess what I mean to say is, in any given analysis, take in your requirements, take in your requirements for readership, take in your requirements for internationalization, take in your requirements for contributions, and you're going to come up with a solution that fits that moment in time.
So what type of contributions have you had from developers? Has it been that you've just not had the time to write? I mean, would there have been gaps in the documentation, or would it have taken longer if you hadn't had it? Let me ask the first question.
Sure.
What type of contributions have you been getting from your developers as a result of taking this approach?
So in OpenStack, for the REST API documentation alone, we had 300 contributors patching the REST API docs. Now, and that was in an XML-based system where we were documenting REST with Waddle, which is a web application description language, a little bit older. We chose it in the 2010 timeframe when it was going to be more of a standard. It has since faded with OpenAPI and some of the RAML standards coming forward. So we have since, and here, let me tell you, those 300 contributors were developers, but they were not building OpenStack. They were building applications on top of OpenStack. And so there was another way to get contributions. It didn't have to be writers assigned to that task. It could be from the community of people using the services that OpenStack provided. Mm-hmm. So again, that's a deep analysis and very complex. Now, what we've done most recently in OpenStack is moved to all of the docs are now embedded in code repos. So we used to have we still have a smaller subset, but like a small set of documentation that's in its own repo. Mm-hmm. That's reviewed by a doc specific team, but we've gone even further and spread the maintenance and responsibility to be even closer with the code. And I think especially, OpenStack is super fast moving, releases every 6 months on the nose, has at one point had 6,000 configuration options, consists of 30 projects that provide services. Like, there's a lot of complexity. And so the simplest, most accurate, like when you choose accuracy and ease of contribution above all else, the docs went right in the code repos with those reviewers responsible for all of the docs. Now, the only way we really could pull that off is by automating the builds, building a framework that was super consistent, because OpenStack consists of probably hundreds of repos by now, all glued together to build services, right? That's, again, not going to apply to everyone. And certainly one of these higher on the complexity scale, but you have to do that analysis. And then once you do the analysis, be ready to flex as needed to pull the different lever that you need at the time.
Hmm. Again, on the complexity side of things, you've got then some documentation in one repo, other documentation that might need to be called upon. You might have partials or includes or fragments of code that go in. How have people, when they're writing content, been able to deal with that complexity of different bit of information coming in from different places, or knowing that they should put those pieces in without, as it were, a WYSIWYG view of the world?
Sure. To be super honest, we have chosen on the side of simplicity. I am trying to think if we have any includes that are not automated by a script. We have tried to make it as easy as possible to contribute to the docs. So reuse is at a file repo level, not at a snippet level.
Right.
Does that make sense? Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. But Jekyll has wonderful ways to use data and snippets, and we do that when we have a repo owned completely by the docs team at Cisco. I'm trying to think, another great example that I'm digging into more at Cisco is developer.cisco.com. And that is completely sourced by Git repos that are hosted on Bitbucket. And so it's very enterprise centric, mm-hmm. but they have made it so that all the BUs, all the business units can contribute and build a single developer.cisco.com site. But again, I think any kind of like inclusion or snippet based complexities are kept to a super small team in the middle.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So you say to your developers, you just write what you need, you know, and what you can contribute. And then things like adding legal disclaimers or warnings or other issues, leave that to us and we'll manage those bits for you and make sure they get added in. So I guess you're simplifying the authoring task for those people. So they can just contribute.
And focus on content or focus on technical accuracy. Right. Well, yeah, the centralized team is the glue and the theme that can hold it all together and the headers and footers. And yes, exactly.
So in gluing it all together so it can be published automatically and you can do overnight generation of documentation. Has that involved using things like liquid scripting and other forms of scripting in the pages or the way in which the content is built?
Yes, in the case of recently moving docs.metacloud.com, which is an OpenStack-based private cloud that I work on at Cisco, mm-hmm. I actually am working on with a web designer. So we have access to a web design group, Interactivism. And so what they've done, and again, this is kind of that, like, yes, as the tech manager, I've had to dabble and understand it at a very deeply technical level, mm-hmm. but he's doing the heavy lifting. So he figured out a way with Liquid to iterate through a list of versions that we wanted to display in a menu. By working together, I figured out, well, no, actually we need to use base URL because of the way we're building. And so anyhow, and then I also added to this, so you know how Jekyll allows you to have access to data in the form of like a YAML file. And so I actually figured out also, well, if I just start listing the versions in this YAML file, mm-hmm. then we can have access to it in every page and in our header.html layout template. Oh, I can iterate through this list and get it accurate every time, even as we add versions. Mm-hmm. So Jekyll, man, super useful in that way. I need to write that up in a blog post too, because once we figured it out, I was like, oh, this opens up so many possibilities.
So let me just, for my benefit and for other people, just double check my understanding. So YAML is yet another markup language. So this is where you'd put in the metadata about the content. So which version it's for, maybe which product, which audience. And then what Jekyll can do is look at that file and then use mm-hmm. that as a mechanism for filtering or creating tables of contents or navigation routes by certain mm-hmm. categories, by product or by version or by language or by that way.
Literally putting it into LI list item HTML tags, and it just goes through a for loop.
And it creates a hyperlink for whatever categories are in that file into the page to navigate.
Yes, and in my case, we have four previous versions that are on separate branches that have to be built, and then a latest. And so now I can just run the build through five times over, and I can access the correct version inside of each build. So that's also important too. And some of this sounds like we're just recreating content management systems, mm-hmm. and I've done that, and believe me, that's not quite what we're doing. We're literally treating pieces of information, key value pairs, version 4.0, version 4.1, as a manipulatable thing that I can reuse over and over. Yeah.
Right. Now, a couple of questions from that. The PDF side of things. Are you mm-hmm. offering your content as PDFs? How have you tackled that?
Oh, that's a good story.
Beast.
Yes. So I wanted to write a book with other people and wanted to use Git or GitHub as sort of the basis of this book. So Docs Like Code is written in GitHub with collaborators. But the odd part was it was a private repo. And since I'm super used to writing in the open, you know, that was an adjustment. And Eric Holscher, the founder of Write the Doc, one of the co-founders of Write the Docs, and I have talked about the struggle, like, I'm so used to giving it away. But in this case, we used a private repo, and I actually added Gitbook webhooks on top of it to get nicely formatted HTML and nicely formatted EPUB. And I thought, I was hoping I'd be able to get nicely formatted PDF out of it. But it's not... It's not that the PDF isn't good. It's actually quite nice. It wasn't good enough for my print sensibilities, shall we say. So what I ended up doing is kind of shopping around. I'm like, well, I could buy a copy of Prince XML. That seems like how people tend to do really, really, you know, or InDesign, Adobe would let you do this as well and do this all myself. Or I could find someone who can do this for me. And so since I was sort of project and product managing this deliverable, I really decided that it's time for me to grow and stretch a little bit. I went to Upwork and found a graphic designer on Upwork, took in bids, figured out how much to pay, and she has done an amazing job. In working on the second edition, the layout is going to be even nicer in my eye. And we're sent, like, I'm literally waiting on a print copy to come to my door to flip through every page. So, and I think that's another point is, like, there's PDF that you deliver online, like, here, have the latest PDF, right? And the styling from Read the Docs is really nice. Any use case where you just need it, like, I'm on a plane, just give me the PDF. That's a perfectly good use case. When you need a print ready copy that you believe every single page is laid out exactly how you want with the exact page breaks that you want, I leave that to the tools and print expertise. Does that make sense?
Yes, be very
careful about your PDF use case, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and also recognize that people still want it as PDF, and just because it's hard, don't argue, well, people don't need it anymore, which is an argument I've seen people slip into
rather too easily. Yeah.
A couple of other limitations. Search. Are you relying on the search you get with Jekyll? Well, is there a search with Jekyll? I'm not sure if there is.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I had to investigate this a lot for a couple of sites I work on. So for docs.metacloud, we ended up using a Google custom search engine that we integrated with the one from developer.cisco.com. We felt that one was the closest match, and they were willing to give us their code and willing to integrate our site into theirs. So, but of course, if you want only the hits from metacloud.com, docs.metacloud.com, you're not getting them with our search. It was a trade-off. Within Jekyll, so my Docs Like Code site has a horrible search engine that just came with the theme, and I just haven't taken the time to get a better one in there. But it basically just takes all of the metadata in each post and only searches in that. So unless you're really good at tagging metadata, you're getting terrible hits. Like, I actually sent someone to the site, and I was like, oh, go search on the site. I know I have an article about, you know, I can't remember what the keyword was. And she comes back, she's like, I can't find it. And I was like, oh. I did discover that the embedded one for that particular theme isn't great. Now, the one I will go with for any Jekyll site, I think, from now on is LunarJS, L-U-N-R. Okay.
That's and, the cut-down version of Solr, isn't it, if I remember correctly?
I believe that's true. Yeah. And so that one, you know, you're building the JSON on the fly so that the keywords are extracted from the entire post, not from just tags. What I saw, I really liked. It had autocomplete in the form. Yeah. And for my versioning situation that we're in now, where we have all these different versions, I'm going to need 5 different JSON files output for each subsite, basically. So yeah, we definitely need to go to a more robust. And you know what I do when I need to find like a specific keyword? I'll just type like volumes space site colon docs.metacloud.com, and Google gives me what I want. Integrating with user experience is the harder part.
And again, on the testing on the limitation side of things here, you're working in an environment with developers, you're using Bitbucket or GitHub. They are used to the joys of GitHub and how it works with adding content, changing content. Would you see that this approach of Docs Like Code working for people who don't normally come into touch with GitHub or Bitbucket or equivalents?
I don't think so. It's very specific to building web-based deliverables. Likely, like, there are people exploring it for, like, healthcare or other government-based options. Now, in the UK, you have a wonderful example of government-based documentation being using Docs Like Code, right? Mm-hmm. So there are certainly, and again, I think it's the upfront analysis, right? Mm-hmm. In a highly regulated industry where you, and this is part of the whole chapter that I wrote up about, would you use a wiki or would you use code version control system? Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is like, well, does the source need to be audited? Does the access to the source need to be locked down? Is there a system already in place that allows that, that enables that in such a way that you're safe in your regulatory system, right? At Cisco, we have Enterprise GitHub. We have access to a lot of different Git-based systems that meet the security requirements that Cisco has and the IT support level that we would expect, you know, at a large company. So, yeah, there's always reasons not to use this. But the successes I have seen in systems and situations just far outweigh any concerns.
Now, one of the challenges with writing documentation for developers that are using Agile is they're writing to often 2-week sprints. Keeping the documentation up to date with the latest version, very tricky. And so often
you need a staging environment, right? Like, you need to start thinking about the way developers think about that production, staging, dev, test.
So are you able to keep up with them? Or are you running a sprint behind? How are you dealing? And does Docs as Code help you speed that process up?
In OpenStack, it's kind of required when you have docs with the code. If someone patches the code, patch the docs while you're doing that, right? And especially in a REST API world, they pretty much require the documentation to be hand in hand.
Yeah.
And don't merge unless the docs are clear. So that's one way of looking at it, right? Is the idea that if it doesn't have docs, it's not finished. Our definition of done includes docs. This shall not pass, right? And having test automation that says, oh, this is missing, you cannot pass your tests. That's when you really get people rallying behind your docs systems. And they're like, oh my tests don't pass, and my manager said they have to pass before I get this thing merged, right? So that's one way to look at this.
So in the definition of done, documentation is included. And if the documentation's missing or wrong, then the sprint would fail and not necessarily be shipped.
That story might not be done. Now, you can also have stories that are, as an end user, I want to understand this thing, right? And so then that story is separate, and that story is not done until the docs tests pass, but the story is not done. The coding of it may not affect the docs. And so that's why this is such a fluid system, right? I can have a story for docs, or I can not have a story for docs. I can have my definition of done include docs or not. I can have the docs team be a complete services unit that just sits on the side, keeps their own backlog, writes their own stories. And if they decide to lag behind, it's not behind if they don't say they're behind, right? So if everyone gets their own definition of done, then they may be, you know, going to a different release date or whatever. So, oh, yeah, there's lots of ways to slice that.
Do you need to know how to code in order to take or to adopt a Docs as Code approach to writing?
I have a long explanation to this, right? So I actually believe there is this artificial hierarchy in most of the tech industry that says that, well, writers are not technical, or I'm a database administrator, so I'm more technical than the Exchange administrator who administers the email server. Or I'm a Python developer, I'm more technical than I don't even know what they stack rank themselves against, right? So there's this artificial hierarchy.
JavaScript people, probably.
Right. Like, but it's totally made up and the points don't matter anyway, right? So I'm stumbling for words because this is something that I just feel so strongly about, that we are making it up if we think we all have to know everything before we go get a job somewhere. You need to understand how to write. You need to understand how to advocate for users. You need to understand how complicated information systems go together. And if you are embedded on a team that also needs you to embed your doc systems with their systems, then by George, they're going to figure out a way to get you there, right? And so I just feel like I'm kind of almost overreacting to that question, because it's like, well, nobody should be asked to know everything right away just to adopt something that makes sense for your business, right? So that's my sense of it is, and I guess too, because I have constantly volunteered in open source or done what I would call like an apprenticeship approach to these things, where I happen to be on teams that were super willing to let me ask questions, super willing to let me poke at systems, figure out what might fit in where, and help me out when I was like, man, I'm in over my head. I don't have this particular tool on my Mac. Why is that? And help me out with understanding the broad base of system integration that you need to understand in any given system to fit into it, right? Does that help? Yeah. I would never tell someone not to do this just because they don't know it. Oh, my goodness.
Out of interest, can you program?
I am, gosh, I can read it better than I can write it. I can kind of write Python, but only because people in OpenStack are very patient with me and my code reviews. I've done the Learn Python the Hard Way. Love that series. And yes. I've met the author, and he's really, really great about self-publishing, and I really appreciated the way he's taken that approach.
So yeah. He has a number of videos, 16, or maybe it's more than that, on YouTube. And it's an accessible guide for people that want to learn Python.
In my case, I could be better at Python if I did it every day, just like I could be better at playing guitar if I did it every day. So I think that's where I'm at, is an unpracticing programmer is not really good at it, right? So
in terms of the tools that people have used for this DOCSIS code approach and the tools that you used for writing the book, what have you used? What have you found that's worked, or does it just really depend on what fits best with what the developers are up to?
Oh, you definitely want to fit in with what the developers are doing, but you know, in the cases that I've seen, if you need the simplest writing approach, then you want something, you know, simple like ASCII doc, markdown, or restructured text, right? So that was the impetus behind those. And in the book, I sort of compare and contrast the Python and Ruby ecosystems from like a doc build or a website build perspective. I found a lot of parallels there. It really, again, it comes back to those, well, what outcome are you most trying to get? And that's your first choice, right? So I'm way more interested in the analysis of how you came to a conclusion about a particular base source, but as long as you're treating it like source, you're there mentally, right? Yeah. And I mean, one of the reasons why I did a second edition of the book was GitHub flavored Markdown has a spec now. And that was always kind of the controversy about Markdown as well. You just don't know how it's going to be interpreted, and nobody knows how to write an interpreter because no one's defined the spec. And
so on the book, you self-published.
Yeah.
Your first book, Conversation Community, was published by O'Reilly, was it?
Right. And so, yeah, the background on that. So Richard Hamilton and I, he's the owner of XML Press and just a wonderful person, a great mentor. And my book was one of the first that he published through XML Press. And I approached him pretty early on. I'm like, Richard, I have this outline. It's almost fleshed out. And I would love to know if you would like to take a look at it. And he's like, Anne, I'm swamped. I've got so many in my backlog. I can't look at it for 3 months. And so I came back and I was like, well, am I really ready to do this on my own? And again, with the outcome or the goal in mind of like, I want to learn how to manage a product end to end. I said, is it okay if I just try this on my own? And he was like, great. And he was one of the early reviewers. Later on, when we actually had it to a point, he tested the Git tutorials. Like, wonderful, wonderful. Thank you, Richard. But what I was able to realize then too is how much work he does. So I was, in this case, author and publisher. Well, I didn't know I had to go get, there's this entire copyright page. I had to go get legal permission from every copyright trademark holder mentioned, you know, so it was a wonderful, not just like writing the book and the things in the book, but a wonderful like meta experience for me of how did these things come together and how much was I relying on other people to do the details, man. Hmm. Lots of details.
So the benefits of taking this approach, what are the main benefits for doing this that you've seen from your experience?
You know, and I've really tried to distill this down by talking to other writers, but we sense that the main benefits are, you know, valuing technical accuracy when doing reviews, reusing development tools in such a way that you get help from the development group to maintain. And so that's where the automation is a huge gain. Mm-hmm. I think that an excellent, amazing web experience is something like there are certain tools that you can't really integrate tightly enough with your own services that you're delivering. And so, like, you know, if we're working on a great dashboard, well, how can I most tightly integrate the docs with that dashboard, right? And so, you know, I think that there's just so much gain to be had in, you know, wonderful web experiences, integrating as closely as possible with the thing that is delivered to customers, making sure that accuracy is valued very highly in your reviews of documentation. Hmm. And, you know, you're going to come up with your own compelling outcomes. And what I'm hoping, and again, this is where I'm still kind of noodling on this while I'm finishing up the second edition, but like, you know, could we have a bit of code in your repository that uses docs-like code and then do an analysis that says, you know what, you're doing great here, but you could improve on these things. You could add more reviewers. You could make sure that writers are reviewing this instead of only developers, right? Like, and I think, so that's kind of at the heart of the controversy, right? Is like, well, if everyone can write and we put these into systems that are developer-centric, then are we cutting the writer out of the deal, mm-hmm. right? And I guess my point is like, we need to apply metrics so that we know what works best. Mm-hmm. We have a sense that writers are better at some things and are going to add value in certain ways. So let's use docs as code to like prove it with data. Mm-hmm. Don't just guess. Yeah.
But that leads on to where you see this going into the future. And again, there seems to be a theme that's coming through is that mm-hmm. future developments are dealing with more complex situations like versioning and analysis, mm-hmm. assessing, using it as a way of quantifying the value and benefit of having good documentation. Is there mm-hmm. is that mm-hmm. right? And is there anything else in addition in terms of the future that you see coming up?
I think in the future, yes, I really want us to not just I want to say this carefully so I don't sound too critical of an entire job career line, but I don't want technical writers to go into defensive mode and an us versus them mode mm-hmm. where they're trying to simply say, I have a job and I need to keep my job. Rather, they're looking at the world with where can I add the most value in a job that is well earned, well respected because I add value in a collaborative way. And I mean, I'm guilty of this as well. A lot of my blog posts are very like, well, if you want to do this, then maybe this will work or, you know, but like if I can say with certainty based on large amounts of data, these things work better than others. Or if you pull these two levers, expect this outcome. Hmm. We're all going to be better off as an industry, as a value-added profession in the confidence that we know what to do, we know when it's right, and we know what pitfalls to avoid. Hmm. So that doesn't answer the future question other than the future's bright, you have to wear shades. I don't know. Now, I believe in the world of web services and in the world of REST API documentation, the documentation and embedding it within an API management system, for example, is going to be business strategic wonderland. Mm. Like this, you know, should elevate the documentation and the outcomes you get from really killer weaponized REST API documentation, to borrow from my colleague at Rackspace, Jesse Noller, always talk about weaponizing the documentation, right? And so that, to me, is going to be the analytics route that's going to help us completely show all the business strategists this is required. This is what you have to play in this space.
Hmm. Now, one other, you mentioned automation. Build automation a number of times. So it would be useful to define that.
I have an article on docs.co.com that specifically goes into this. What does it even look like? What does automation mean? You know, so building docs like code. So what happens is you have, I'm trying to think of what base layer to start with. So a repository is a collection of flat files that you happen to be able to edit on your local computer and upload to github.com if that's your, you know, web UI of choice. Yeah. And so in github.com, there are a lot of integration points where you can have these builders build it for you. And so Travis CI is one example.
Mm-hmm. Jenkins,
Circle CI,
yeah.
All of those are integration points that are called webhooks. And so those can be using settings on your GitHub repo. You can say, yes, I want to integrate with Travis, or yes, I want to integrate with Circle CI. And so there are specific, sometimes like YAML files, oftentimes, where you read their documentation to find out exactly what I put in here. And in the repo itself, I happen to keep a set of bash scripts. And so those are written and tested locally, and then I upload them to the repo. Mm-hmm. And the continuous integration system, such as Jenkins, is saying, I'm going to read that script and do whatever it tells me to do. And so often that's in the context of the repo. And then it's oftentimes building on like a cloud server running somewhere. And so like in the case of OpenStack, we have thousands of virtual machines that we use to build. So it sets up a virtual machine with exactly the prereqs that are needed to build the documentation. The files are basically cloned from the repository to that virtual machine. The virtual machine says, what script am I running again? And your CI system tells it, and it runs it right in there. And in the case of static site generators, which is what we're using oftentimes for this, where it takes flat files and turns them again into flat files that a web server can read and host for you. So in the case of, you know, let's take a Jekyll example.
Which is a web,
which is a static site generator. Yeah. Yep. It has a bunch of Ruby gems that you may or may not need that relate to your theme or relate to Jekyll itself. A super simple example, if anybody just wants like a pet project over the weekend to say, I used Git for documentation, is to run through one of the GitHub Pages tutorials. And that GitHub Pages is a product that GitHub offers that basically hosts these HTML files. And you can just make a website with Jekyll and build automation, making your HTML for you. And then they're serving it on their servers. Is that good enough for
continuous integration? Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I could get more into dependency management and, you know, what you need to build. But suffice it to say, something like GitHub Pages has really thought through the safest dependencies for their system. Yes, it's a limited set, but by George, you can get up and running quickly.
So if people want to look at this in more detail and they want to get your book and they want to look at your your blog.
Yes, docslikecode.com. Docsascode.com is a mirror of the same thing. And somebody tell me the grammatical rules I should be following, please. But yeah, and the thing about Docs Like Code is it is a working website that is built from GitHub itself. That's a public repo. So if you see a typo, you can file an issue. If you would like to write an article about how you've used Docs Like Code in your own work environment, whether it's a spectacular story or a miserable failure and there were tears, I want to hear it and I want to publish it. So please do reach out with, I will work with you, even if it's like your first PR on GitHub ever and you just want a place to try it out, I'm happy to help people with that as well.
So PR,
I feel like the goal here is, yeah,
PR is pull request.
Pull request. So even if you're not familiar with GitHub and all of the acronyms I just use, absolutely reach out, make a GitHub account, go find the docs-like code repo and start poking around. Use it as your sandbox. I would love that.
Lovely. Well, I think that's all my questions.
Great.
And lovely talking to you as always. At this point, I'll wind up and say thanks for listening to the podcast.